Welcome to the Berean class. We are interrupting our study of John with a short series before Easter on one verse in James, James 1, verse 19. And we'll conclude that this morning. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You've never heard that before, have you? Everyone's heard that. The question is this: is it true?
No.
Well, yes, it is. Only if you are not listening or don't care. And not listening and not caring are two things that it's hard to avoid, or we shouldn't avoid, in many respects. This is the passage we're looking at. But everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. The last 2 weeks we talked about being quick to hear, and that involves the way in which we hear God's Spirit speaking in us, and the way in which we hear God's Word speaking to us, and also the way in which we listen to one another, the way in which we hear what people are saying. Why is the tongue so important? And this is an outline of basically where we're going to go. We're going to touch on all of these issues. It's vital to spiritual community. It's not the only way we communicate, but it's one of the, as human beings, one of the unique ways in which we communicate, and most powerful ways. It makes a big difference in lives, whether we realize it or not. Matter of fact, more so than we realize. It is one of the greatest challenges we face in the Christian life. And then, how can we manage it? Well, the short answer to that is, we can't. James says, no one can manage that until they're perfect. If you can manage your tongue, you're a perfect person. It starts, however, what we can do is with our heart, with our attitude. As we're going to see, if our heart's right, we tend to say the right things. When it's not right, it's pretty hard not to say the things we shouldn't say. Be sensitive to context. We're going to see that what we say really is affected by the context in which it's said. And become a good listener. There's a reason James says be quick to listen first before he talks about being slow to speak and slow to anger. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 7. There is a time for silence and a time to speak. And what the wisdom of Solomon tells us is that it's good to hold your tongue, but also it's necessary for you to speak up at certain times. And there's no virtue in just never speaking. Speaking is needed to connect ourselves with others. When we don't speak well or appropriately at the right time, we don't connect. Four psychologists wrote a book that I've referred to on a number of occasions in the past, Connecting with Self and Others. And this book has a lot of insights that I thought were very helpful. This is not written from a Christian perspective, but it's written from the observation of people who look at the image of God working through human beings. And they identify something that I thought was very helpful in terms of distinctions. They talk about small talk, different types of talk. Small talk is a talk that's very safe. What's the weather like today? What's it going to be like? Is it going to be sunny all day long? Is it going to get up to 70 above? That's very safe. No one's going to feel threatened by that. We can make connection at a certain level, but no one is going to say, what's behind that? You know, or what's wrong with you? That's not going to happen. Then there's shop talk. That's a little more intimate. How about them heels? Wasn't that a great game? Or whatever. There you're taking a little bit more of a risk. If you're talking to a Duke fan, they're saying, no. Then there's shield talk. Shield talk is basically changing the subject because I don't want to talk about that. That's getting too personal. Or that's a place I don't want to go. It's talk that basically is designed to deflect or change the direction of the conversation. We all have been there. We've seen it and we've used it. Usually,
politics
is a great example of that. Then there's what they call steer talk. I don't know if they use that word, but I had to get an S. Steer talk. Steer talk is what a teacher does. That's what I'm trying to do right now. I'm trying to basically lead you to understand things in a certain way, or to believe something, or to do something. It's what a teacher does. It's what all of us do in conversations. We try to convince someone of something, or to get them to do something. We steer them. But it's not until we get to safe talk and straight talk that we have connecting. We have community. Safe talk, and Jim Huegerich coined that word. I use the word search talk. I like Jim's comment last Sunday with respect to safe talk. That's conversation that makes it safe for you to be honest with me, where I communicate to you that I really am going to listen without judging, that I'm going to make it safe for you to be honest. I'm going to make it safe for you to give me straight talk. Straight talk is when I speak from my heart. Safe talk is when I basically convince you it's safe for you to do that. This is where connecting takes place. And the reason many of us who have been in small groups have basically at the end said, well, this small group did not work as well as it should have. After 2 years of meeting together, we still don't really feel very close to one another. The reason for that is because almost all the talk had been up here someplace. It was not down here. It was not heart to heart. It was more shield to shield or image to image. And the kind of talk most of us have that we call fellowship is really my image speaking to your image, my people talking to your people, as opposed to my heart talking to your heart, where I'm not telling you what really scares me in this relationship, or what really gives me a sense of peace in this relationship, or not only in this relationship, in any relationship. How many of the people we talk to really know what scares us in life? Even our mates don't know that sometimes. Our children don't know that. Our parents don't know that. Because we haven't been using straight talk. Yes?
It's interesting. People very often when traveling are more likely to, when safe talk and straight talk, talk to a total stranger.
Exactly.
Some things they wouldn't agree with telling them.
This takes place in a bar more than a church. No, really. Really. We will tell things, you'll tell things to your doctor or your lawyer that you would, or counselor that you'd never speak to your mate or your family, which is really at least interesting and sad. And the church should be the place that's full of safe talk and straight talk. But so often, it never gets past much of this, and a whole lot of this, and of course, a lot of this. That's the problem. So the point of this book, is, in terms of take-home for me, is that in developing community, we need to really concentrate on getting to the place where we communicate not just with our heart, but from our heart. It's not just getting emotional and passionate about what we believe or say. It's basically being honest with who we really are. Yes? Gossip is usually shield talk. It's basically, I'm trying to bolster my image. My insecurities are coming out in gossip. Gossip generally reflects insecurities. It's steer talk too, in the sense that I'm trying to convince other people to agree with me about this situation that I feel uncomfortable with. We don't gossip about people that we really love and care for. We gossip about people that basically, in some way, we feel not necessarily threatened by, but don't agree with. Our words have power. Now, this is not news to most of us, but I think it is something that we need to be reminded of often. Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And those who love it will eat its fruit. And what this passage suggests strongly is this. Your tongue has a lot of power, and you're going to live with the consequences. If you use your tongue, you're going to live with both the good and the bad that comes from that. Chaim Gnat, who is the mentor of the two women who wrote the book I cited last week, How to Speak, the title of the book was How to Speak So Your Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Your Kids Will Speak. Brilliant book. He is the person who taught these women, and this is what he says. If you want your children to improve, let them overhear the nice things you say about them to others. That is so true. That is so true. And very frankly, one of the greatest compliments that someone can hear is when you overhear them talking about you in a very favorable way. As a matter of fact, it's hard to forget those things. I was at a party, a community party, at St. Patrick's Day 3 weeks ago, and one of our neighbors was talking to one of our other neighbors about us, and they were saying some very nice things, which were exaggerated. But I was so thankful. But the point is, I would have never expected this from this neighbor. But hearing that had a powerful effect on me, the fact that they thought that highly of us as neighbors. It was something I wouldn't have expected. But when they say it to your face, you're wondering, is it really being honest? When they say it to someone else and they don't think you're hearing, it's more likely to be trusted, and therefore it's more powerful. And boy, is that true of kids. Kids hear everything we say, and that is scary. They're God's little spies. Parents talk about the younger generation as if they did not have anything to do with it. This is another one of his quotes that I think is so great. I mean, we can really rag on the next generation as though somehow we didn't contribute to what's going on there in that culture. Anxiety in a heart's man weighs it down, but a good word makes it glad. A good word makes it glad. Our words affect the fear in those around us. I'm going to make reference to a person in this class. Several years ago, Jews for Jesus was invited to speak on the campus. And this was very controversial. If you're familiar with the Jews for Jesus Christian ministry, they're very controversial. And I was sponsoring them. They had to get someone on the community to sponsor them. I sponsored them. Well, the rabbi was furious. And the Daily Tar Heel had a big article about this. I was called in to the chancellor's office with the other chaplains and dressed down in terms of this whole situation of inviting this controversial group. And I asked them if anyone had heard the group. No, they hadn't heard the group, but the rabbi is upset, and that's enough for us. And I remember Lib wrote me a note. I don't know if you remember this, Lib. He wrote me a note saying, basically, sig 'em. Lib can do that. And I didn't know who Lib was. I knew her name, but I didn't know who she was. But I can remember when I was catching that heat, and when the rabbi told me that if this happened again, he could not guarantee my family's safety. The Jewish Defense League was going to be down here, and I would be paying for it. It got pretty bad, pretty nasty. But no one else, everybody else was like, what are we going to do? And I wasn't going to defend myself in that situation. But it was, I still remember that note when she was basically encouraging me to, she didn't know me from, well, she knew who I was, but I don't think she knew me at that time, encouraging me to hold my ground and not be discouraged. And I wasn't the person who was waffling so much, but I remember how encouraging it was to just have a note of someone on the sidelines watching and saying, stay the course, so to speak. A word in the right time, the right place, makes a big difference. And all of us perhaps have many opportunities to do that. And when we are hold our tongue in those situations, we don't do anyone a service. There are times when it's really important you speak and not speak. It'll make a difference. How do you respond to ideas and feelings of others? There are two ways in which you can do this. When someone has an idea, let's say you're on a committee. Some of us have been on committees. And you're basically brainstorming in terms of ideas. There are two ways in which you can respond to a person's idea, especially if it's bad, a bad idea. And all of us who have been in committees have had bad ideas put up. You can say, no, because this will not work, because bang, 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 five reasons. Or you can say, this will work if bang, 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 bang. Now, why the difference? You're saying the same thing. Here's the difference. When you hear this, are you going to bring back an idea again ever? No. You are shut down because of the fear you have of being rejected. When I put up an idea and somebody rolls their eyes and says, where did that come from? Next, you know, kind of thing. That sends a message. People don't want to hear my ideas unless they are winners. When I hear this, my idea may be rejected, but I'm assured that someone's taking me seriously as a person. And I will offer other ideas, even if this is not accepted. So the way in which we respond verbally to criticism or bad ideas, any ideas, is really important. The first thing we do in our response is to communicate how much respect we have for the person in that situation. And then we talk about the pros and cons of the idea. Proverbs 15, verse 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Our words also affect the anger in those around us. Not just the fears, but the anger as well. This is true especially when we are criticized. Now, I don't think probably many of you have ever been criticized. Is that right? Well, if you're a teacher, you get criticized a lot. And I can remember one person in the congregation, the person is not in this room, and they will not hear this tape, who was a dear friend, someone I greatly respected. But one of the things that I especially respected is the fact that when they disagreed with me, they let me know. And I can remember several times them coming into my office when I was a pastor, teaching pastor, and saying, I disagree. You know, this is what you said, and I disagree with it. I think you're out to lunch. And my initial response was always one of saying, yes, but you did not listen to me correctly. That's not what I said. Listen to the tape. I didn't say that. Going to my defense. And I couldn't figure out why it never worked. It just never worked. And finally, I learned, and it took me a long time to learn this, that the first responsibility I had when being criticized was to demonstrate how to take criticism. That's my first thing. And then what I needed to say was, let me hear, is this what you're saying? Let me think about that. Let me go back and revisit that. And then let's go back and talk. That's what I should have said, but that is not what I said for a long time. Eventually I got to that point, but I had to remind myself often when criticism would strike, my first responsibility as a leader especially, or as someone who wants to be, needs to be respected, is demonstrate how to receive criticism. It works in our families, it works in our with our children, with our mates, so forth and so on. Yes?
I think the first most effective thing is magic, is that you say, thank you for telling me.
Yes, yes.
That thank you, that just opens up all kinds of space.
That really does. And in this class, there have been, in the past, people who have had the boldness to email me with areas they disagree with. And one of the things, because I'd learned this the hard way, I always write them back and say, first of all, thank you for having the courage, you know, to challenge this. And let me look at this. And oftentimes, I found that they were exactly right. that I'd overlooked something, some information I used was incorrect, wasn't properly cited, so forth and so on. And then get back with him afterwards and say, you were right, when I can say that. Say, you're right, thank you for correcting that. Now oftentimes, deep inside I'd say, but you know, you're picking at something that's really trivial. The main point is being missed here. But that's not the point to say that. That's not the place to say that. Yes?
But the main point is never being missed for them.
Right.
It really tells us what they
think. Exactly.
Not so much what we said. You don't care so much about what we said. And
right.
They are criticizing them. We know about them. It's not about us.
Exactly. And again, the relationship, community, the relationship really is the treasure here that you want to preserve.
And feedback is always about them, if we really listen to it.
That's a very good point. It's a very good point. The three G's of wise speech. Genuine, gracious, gentle. Genuine. People sense when you're just basically playing a game. You've got to be honest. Straight talk. That's straight talk. But be sensitive, gracious, and gentle in doing it. Sometimes you don't want and cannot be boldly honest. You've got to consider the context, be gentle, and consider who you're speaking to and how they're hearing it, so forth and so on. So often, our concern is only in getting out how we feel as opposed to considering how they're going to feel or how they're going to hear us in a situation like that. And that is vitally important. What marks a Christian's tongue is their ability to empathize with how they're being heard and then to tailor their message, their speech, in such a way that it minimizes the distortion that takes place in hearing. If you want a good negative example of speech that excites anger, turn on the news. The media sells anger. Anger sells. And on both political sides, I know people on the right think only the left do that. People on the left think only the right do that. Both people on the left and the right are selling news. And they sell news by exciting anger. If they can excite a passion. I took a course in journalism when I was in college, an elective course. And one of the things I remember from the course was this. The person said, and I don't know if this is wise or not, but this is what I remember from the course. If you want to have a good newspaper article, you have to have a victim. You have to have a hero. And you have to have a villain. And throw in a puppy, if you can. You have to have the children of Israel, Moses, and Pharaoh. And that makes a story. People want a hero, they want a villain, and they want someone who's suffering with a puppy or a baby. That makes a story people will read. And they're right. When we pick up a magazine, that's what we want to, hear a news report, that's what gets ratings. People tune in for that. The media knows that. And it basically excites anger with its reporting so often. Yeah, this is why most of us have learned to really take what we hear through the media with a grain of salt. Now, when it agrees with us, with our prejudice, we like it. When it doesn't, we demonize it. But recognize that the media is interested in a lot of things, one of them being ratings. And they know, and we know, that by turning up the volume, people will listen to us. Now, of course, what happens, whenever we exaggerate or unfair or don't have a gentle answer, it's not gracious or gentle, but it's passionate, we can be assured of one thing. When we turn up the volume, they turn up the volume. When I basically see one side of a story of someone who is disagreeing with me, they are going to feel unheard, and their response is going to be to turn up the volume, to marshal an army behind them. And before you know it, we've got a civil war going on. A mountain or a molehill becomes a mountain. this is so often what happens in quote-unquote communities. Little things become big things because they aren't heard early.
And you end up splitting the church.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or families. And certainly relationships. But boy, are we excited. That's the important thing. James 3:2. For we all stumble in many ways, but if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. Also to bridle the whole body. The use of our tongue is perhaps the hardest ethical challenge we face. Now, I've known this for a long time, but when I was preparing this aside series, waiting for Easter to come so we could continue our study of John, I've been embarrassingly ashamed of how often I've violated the things that I've taught. I know in my head what to do, and I've learned how to do this over time, but I'm amazed how quickly I can default to the wrong thing, just saying yes but in response to something I don't want to hear, or not making it safe for people to criticize me. I don't want to hear criticism. I'll change the subject or basically penalize you for criticizing me. I don't want to be that way, but I find myself instinctively doing that. The amazing truth about human speech: it takes 3 years to acquire it and a lifetime to learn how, when, and where to use it. And that is true. In this life, James says, we're not going to be able to manage it completely. It's always going to be a challenge. James 1:26. If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. Our words are a sign of our spiritual maturity or lack thereof. Now, there are many ways in which we can assess spiritual maturity. Here are some of the ways that Scripture mentions and that catch my attention. Now, I wouldn't have mentioned these things 40 years ago, but after years of living and teaching as a pastor, this is what I would look at. And if you were asking me to assess a person's spiritual maturity, I would not say how much of the Bible do they know. That does not mean a thing to me. How they use their money, that'll tell me a lot more. How they make it, how much attention they give to it, and how they spend it, how they give it, so forth and so on. How we respond to personal success and failure. What happens when you're a winner? What happens when you're a loser? How do you respond? That tells me a lot about where your hope is. Or even more so, how we respond when we suffer. When we get bad doctor's report, or when we go through a period of pain, or when we're disappointed in people around us and our family, for example, or go through a divorce or a big loss in our family. How do we respond to those things? That'll tell me a lot about where our hope is and where we are spiritually. How we respond to the great and least among us. How we relate to those who are powerful and those who have no power at all. That tells me a lot about where a person is spiritually. But the most important is how we use our tongue. Scripturally, this is the one that, this is the issue that specifically is mentioned with respect to a gauge of maturity. How does a person speak to themselves and to others, and to God? What do we say? When do we say it? Yes?
Jim, I'd throw on the flip side of that coin is not only how do we use our tongue, but how we don't. I think of Christ, who defended himself. So how do we respond when under attack?
Right, right.
It comes back to what Hope was saying. Thank you, because perhaps there is something in that attack that I need to hear and learn about.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and I think when I'm speaking of using the tongue, it's basically shutting it up. And I think that's a very good point. It's holding our tongue as well as using our tongue in the sense of speaking. That's very important. We say much more, especially when we are criticized, by the way in which we respond to the criticism. then to the issue that's being criticized. There'll be a time to correct those things, but that correction will be very difficult if we shut the door in the relationship with the critic. Yes?
The most powerful place, there's a theory that I use all the time, and it's called the interpersonal circle. And the most powerful place to come from, if somebody is criticizing us, which is a little dominant and hostile, even, is from dominant and friendly, so to say, tell me more about that. It just shocks them so much. And when did you start thinking that? Or all those, just really asking questions to explore it more, they will then become very cooperative. I mean, it just transforms that dominant, hostile kind of behavior.
Or if we think about issues, especially as not my issue, it's our issue. So we're both contributing. I've made a contribution. You're responding with a different contribution. And basically, it's a community or a fellowship issue as opposed to my integrity against your integrity. This is why it is so difficult when someone stands up boldly in Christian circles and says, God spoke to me that we should build a building or that we should move to a different place. That closes the discussion because they're saying, basically, if you disagree with that, you're disagreeing with God. It's much safer and more appropriate to say, my strong impression as I pray is that this is the wise way to go. What do you think? Do you have the same message? When we say we have got the message, and that settles it, the discussion's over.
Another way that is sometimes phrased is when you don't have enough faith.
That's right. That's right. If you were in touch with God, you'd get the same message. And there have been a lot of churches that basically have split over the fact that they've got leaders with two different messages from God. And then it's a matter of my integrity spiritually and your integrity spiritually. Which one of us really is in touch with God? We're fighting then for our dignity, our personal dignity as Christians. That's a sad place to be, but it happens a lot. For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. And the point here is this. Managing the tongue starts with giving attention to the heart. My impression strongly has been is when our heart is right, we will generally say the right thing. And when our heart is influenced by fear and anger, we are likely to say the wrong thing, no matter how well we disguise it, no matter how passionately we talk about it. People can read between the lines of our speech, tone of voice, body language, so forth and so on. When our heart is right, our intentions are good. Even if we don't get the words right, people get the message. When our intention is not good, it's hard to hide that. So if we're going to basically give attention to managing our speech, the first place we start is attitude, inner attitude. And if basically I have the attitude that it's God and me and the rest who need to be convinced of this, I'm starting in a very difficult place. Unless you're a prophet of God, but even so, Paul says the prophets are subject to the prophets. Those who speak prophetically have got to listen to others who are speaking the message as well. They do not have the last word. It's interesting in the dramatic example of a controversy in the church in Acts chapter 15, we have these words. The apostles were disagreeing on where the Gentiles fit into the church. And the way in which Luke describes it, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to do this, this, and this. What is this seeming good business? Where is someone who is in touch with God? You know, we want a word that settles it right here. It seems good. Well, that was an honest expression that we should listen to. Here we have the apostles coming to an agreement because it seemed right after they put their minds together. I mean, how unholy is that sounding? Well, the point is, it sounds very wise. A sharp tongue and an unrenewed mind are usually found in the same head. Again, our spiritual maturity is going to be reflected in terms of how we speak and what we say.
Jim?
Yes?
Are our facial expressions connected to the tongue?
Yeah. We're getting there. We're getting there. Matthew 15, verse 11. It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth. This defiles a person as well. What comes out of the mouth, Jesus said to the Pharisees, who were concerned about what they're eating. Were they getting the right food? Was it kosher or not? And at the same time, they were hostile toward one another, and especially to people that weren't like them. Our words can render us defiled before God and destructive before man. It's not just that we destroy others. We tend to basically have an effect upon our own spiritual relationship with God, with our tongue. He who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from troubles. And the idea here is, when we speak, our words can not only expose a bad heart, they can also exacerbate it. They can make it worse. This is why the way in which we talk to ourselves, the way in which we talk to others, comes back to us. And when we say bad things or the wrong thing or insensitive things enough, we are affected by that. Now, I'm not of the persuasion that we can speak things into existence. I hear television evangelists talk about be careful to only say things that you want. Never be negative, always be positive. And I know what they're trying to say, but yet I know what they're trying to say, is that somehow you can manipulate God by just saying the right words. That's not true, but they have a point in this regard. The way in which we talk to ourselves and to others does have an effect on us. And if we're always negative, always whining or worrying, that affects us. It has a snowballing effect. And we tend to become whiners and worriers, whining about the past and worrying about the future, and not really worshiping in the present, and being thankful for where we are. These kind of things are contagious, too. When we're around people who are whining and worrying, we tend to be affected by that negatively. With digging yourself into a hole, the first step is stop digging. Have you heard that before? You basically got to recognize I've got a problem with whining and worrying. Well, the first thing I need to do is not just continue to whine and worry. I've got to control my tongue at a certain point. Let no corrupt talk come out of your mouths, but only such as good for building up of the body, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And this is a long passage in Ephesians chapter 4 on the use of the tongue, on the function of the body of Christ, which is very helpful. Managing the tongue demands sensitivity to context. Give attention to timing, occasion, need, and grace. And this is true in many respects with respect to almost every area of life. The tone, the body language, the posture we take when we speak are a part of the speech process. We can say the right words, but if they're said in the wrong way at the wrong time, can be very destructive in one place and very healing in another. And knowing how to judge that goes back to listening. If we want to be listened to, the best thing to do is to be a good listener. So we'll know basically how people are going to hear us. An apt answer, a timely word, is a joy and delight to those who hear it. The words must be sensitive to the need of the moment. And all of us have probably been in situations where someone has been there with an encouraging word at the right moment, or someone has shown up with, that's not what we needed to hear right now, even though it may have been true. I've used examples like this before, most of them negative in my experience, where I've tried to help people by giving them practical advice to solve the problem when the problem was not the problem they're presenting. The problem was they felt alone. And the important thing that I needed to be reminded of is right now they just need someone to affirm their pain and to say, you may be completely lacking in objectivity in terms of what's going on, but I understand your hurt and your pain. I don't necessarily share the way you responded to it, but I do affirm the fact that, and I put myself in your shoes, this would really hurt, this must really hurt. And when they hear that, when they hear that they're not alone, that someone is willing to take time to be with them for a moment, then they can listen. But if I say, listen, in the name of Jesus, snap out of it. You're calling yourself a Christian? You shouldn't be bothered about this. You shouldn't be worried about this. It's easy to say that. Next. You know, I'm a busy person. Who's next? And everybody else is leaving the room and saying, not me. That kind of counsel is not going to help us. Benjamin Franklin. Remember not only to say the right thing in the right place, but far more difficult still, to leave unsaid the wrong thing in the tempting moment. That is so true. To hold our tongue, it is very, very difficult. Now I'm going to talk about something that's sensitive. Not that these things haven't been sensitive. Most people recognize different types of truth-telling. Lying. Different types of lying. First of all, there are black lies. Satan says, you surely shall not die, to Eve. It's a lie. The moment she ate of the fruit, she lost contact with life. Matthew 26, verse 74, Peter, were you one of them? Follower of Jesus? I do not know the man. He said that to protect himself. Lies to cause harm to others or to protect the liar. Ordinarily, when we think of lies, this is what we think of. We should be telling the truth, not lying. But there are gray areas, gray lies. The most conspicuous example is in sports. The quarterback fakes one play and does another. We applaud. He lied, he deceived. We applaud him, his skill. World War II, we would be all speaking German, perhaps, if the Allies had not successfully deceived Hitler in the invasion of Europe with lies. False information that Hitler bought in terms of where the Allies were going to land. And the German troops were sent to Belgium and not to France, to Normandy. Gracious situations in family relations. When my grandchildren came back from their first violin recital, Grandpa, how did I do? Honey, you were great. Well, that's a lie. It's not a lie. It's a gray area. She's not ready for the concert hall yet. But at her stage, this was a something we want to encourage her with. So I'm not going to say anything negative about her. I say, well, you got to practice a lot more. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to encourage her. Or does this dress make me look fat? Well, yeah, it kind of does. that's not what you want to say. Then there are white lies. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 5. I do not know where the men went when the spies were being protected. Or Corrie ten Boom's sister protecting Jews from German officials. Lies that serve a noble end. In other words, lying is still a lie, but here it's serving a higher purpose. Now this is the controversial part. there are many Christians who believe this is never, ever acceptable. That the midwives protecting Moses, the protecting of the spies, and Corrie Ten Boom's sisters protecting the Jews, inexcusable. They should have told the truth or find some creative way to do that. The point is, in a broken world, we're going to have competing virtues, and we have to have a hierarchy of what's most important. Sometimes we have to make a choice between two things that are evil. When a person is starving to death, when my children are starving to death, and we're lost in the mountains and we come across an apple orchard with a fence around it that says, no trespassing, but I can cross the fence and pick apples for my children and they will live, am I sinning when I'm doing that? I'm breaking the law. I'm intruding on someone else's private property. Yes, technically I am. But is that the right thing to do? I think it is in certain circumstances. Now again, this is touchy. People will debate this, and I'm not going to settle that debate. So if you disagree with me, tough luck. No, I think there's a legitimate room for debate here in this situation, but I think this is the kind of difficult situation that takes place in a broken world.
Now, Jim, you're not paying attention to your lesson. You just said tough luck.
That's my point. I'm making a joke of it. You were listening, Charles. Thank you. He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. The last point is this. Sensitive listening is vital to sound speaking. We learn the most by how well we listen. If we listen so as to understand before we respond, we will not look like a fool, nor will we be ashamed in the end. The point is, can we consistently do that? This side of heaven, probably not. But we can try. And the more we do that, the better off we are. Before you pray, forgive. Before you spend, earn. Before you start, plan. Before you run, walk. Before you quit, try. We'll all agree with that. How about this? Before you critique, reflect. And before you speak, listen. That's the point of this lesson. Before we criticize, think. What can I learn about this? And what is the most important thing for me to do at this point? To get the record right? To protect myself? My integrity? Or to build a bridge to this person? And to understand where they're coming from and what they see that I don't? The thing that is perhaps the most commonly overlooked piece of wisdom that comes to most of us is that our critics oftentimes see something we don't. Now, they may be wrong in terms of the details. They may have a bad attitude toward us or motives. But more often than not, they see something we need to see. And if we can basically hitchhike on that and learn from that, we're better off. If we basically put up a shield and say, I'm not going to go there, whenever I hear that again, I'm not going to listen to it. I'll have no part in that. That's when we not only end a relationship, we end insight. Be swift to listen, slow to speak. That's the essence of this verse, and that's what we've talked about the last 3 weeks. Next week, we will pick up in John chapter 20.
Okay, Christ is near.